Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Face Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle. I am your host, Brian Dillman. Today we have another installment of the Top 10 Books in Mormon History with Ben Park. This is part 8 of the series, and here we discuss Armand Moss's The Angel and the Beehive. Throughout the discussion, we mention a few other articles and books that you might be interested in. For links to those materials, head over to the blog post. And with that very short intro in hand, let's jump right to it. All right, I got Ben Park here for one more book in Mormon history. Although this one, it is and it isn't a Mormon history book. The Angel and the Beehive, The Mormon Struggle with Assimilation by Armand Moss. He was a sociologist, and we'll get into that in more detail, but it's kind of interesting how this, it's history, but it's approached differently than, say, Reeves' book was or some of the others.
Right. I think one could argue whether it's historical sociology or sociological history. He's kind of blending the boundaries between these two disciplines.
He must have been a pioneer in interdisciplinary work.
Right. Maybe we'll just call it religious studies and it covers all fronts.
Right? There you go, religious studies. All right. Well, we are ready to go. Let's jump into Angel and the Beehive. Give us some of the background of this era in the Mormon history world.
Sure. Going to retread a little bit about what we said last month in preface to Kathleen's book, but it's so important just to talk about the dearth of work on 20th century Mormon history. The few works that have been done on the 20th century are focused on either a single individual, a biography, or a group of people and an event. And because it's usually attached to a specific grouping of documents that a scholar gets access to. But what we have in Moss's book is one of the very few works that approach the 20th century thematically and try to make broad arguments that span decades and groups of people and really structure how we view the century as a whole. And as a result, it has a lot more explanatory power, both for the development of change over time, as well as understanding what lots of Mormons were doing and thinking rather than just a single Mormon was doing and thinking.
Right. A lot of the time period that we're going to be talking about through this book is covered in David O. McKay's biography. It's a very different view where David O. McKay, it's a lot about the institutional church and specific programs, specific initiatives, and how he was involved at the highest levels, where Moss goes over some institutional stuff, but also what it's like as a member, how beliefs changed, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And one can argue the success of him getting into the average Mormon, but he's making he's definitely making it a focus, and he has a lot of data that he's working with, we can say. And so I guess it'd be helpful to talk about Moss's own background. So Armand Moss is a sociologist. He taught at Washington State University for several decades. He was trained at Berkeley in California. He made a career mostly through articles, writing a lot of very influential articles in sociology of religion as well as in Mormonism, and wrote some really important articles on Mormons and race, in fact, but did not turn out a book until it was quite late in his career in the 90s when he published this Angel and the Beehive, which drew from his decades of research. And I think it's fun to remember that Moss is one of the first generation of new Mormon historians. I mean, he is a contemporary with Richard Bushman and Leonard Arrington. In fact, at the Mormon History Association conference this last summer, they had a picture in the program because it was the 50th anniversary. They had a picture from one of the very first meetings of the Mormon History Organization. And there was Armin Moss in the background.
Oh, that's cool.
Which was fun. So he wrote this book later on in his career, to summarize a lot of the things that he had been tracing. He followed that up a decade later with the book All Abraham's Children, which looks at Mormon conceptions of race. And then most recently, he wrote a memoir, a very helpful overview of his life as a Mormon intellectual and various things that he was involved with, including the Dialogue, Journal of Mormon Thought, the establishment of the Claremont program in Mormon studies, and other things that really gives a vibrant look of a Mormon progressive life in the post-World War II era.
So I didn't know he was part of establishing Claremont Mormon Studies program. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, after he retired from Washington State, I guess he has kids in Southern California, so he and his wife moved down to the Claremont area just when they were starting the fundraising and the establishment of the chair. So he taught as an adjunct, he serves on the board, he's very active in all their activities. And so, yeah, he's been a stalwart presence down there.
Cool. Before we move on, I remember looking at some of your lists that you'd made years before, and you always had All Abraham's Children on there, if I remember right. Could you briefly contrast that to Reeves' book? Because they're both about Mormonism and race.
Right. Well, I think the most obvious difference is Moss's book focuses on the 19th and the 20th century. So it has a much longer view of Mormon conceptions of race. He talks about Mormons and Native Americans, African Americans, and Jews. He's also very focused on the internal dimensions of this. What are the intricacies that are going on within the Mormon tradition? Not so much as using it as an example to understand broader American notions of race.
Okay, so it's more focused on Mormonism itself.
Right. And it's still a phenomenal resource, and anyone interested in Mormon and race relations should still read it.
Okay. We kind of talked about sociology versus history a little bit already. What are some other things that we should be aware of, since we've mostly been talking about history books?
Right.
Is there something else that we should preface before we jump into it?
Right. Well, Moss's book isn't that big of a leap for us that are interested in history, because he is interested in historical elements of sociology. But there are still important parts about sociology that should be understood, that they like things like stating propositions about how human beings work, and they'll do these in like bullet points. And this sometimes can look weird to us historians because we're just not used to that format. They use lots of surveys. They use lots of data. They use polling. They use the dreaded in-text citation format, which drives me batty. But most especially, they're very theoretical in a lot of ways, because they're trying to use either historical or contemporary or whatever their topic is, as examples to bring out lessons about the human condition, right? They're trying to tell us how humans operate. And so his history tries to do that to a degree, but from a different angle. So it's important to remember how sociology goes about the work, how it relates to history. So it's still talking about a lot of the same things, but sometimes with a different accent.
Yeah, and one other book that comes to mind that we've already covered is Catherine Dane's, where she was pulling up census data and treating it similarly. And she was contrasting different cultures that were both impoverished in England and in southern Utah, and talking about how they coped with the poverty in different ways with their different marriage systems or different social systems. So if you've already read that one, this isn't too much of a leap to getting used to looking at the data tables, looking at the charts. It's not just a strict narrative like a lot of the other histories are. There's charts that, you know, instead of blazing through pages, you have to sit there and figure out what the charts mean, what the tables mean,
right?
That sort of a thing.
Yeah, sociologists love them some charts.
Yeah, data.
Yeah, who needs it?
All right, well, let's jump into the book then.
The thesis of the book is quite simple, and it makes a lot of sense once you hear it. The broader argument about religion and humanity is that religion functions best when it finds an optimal balance between assimilation and isolation, between mixing into broader cultures but still maintaining a sense of uniqueness. And so in Moss's arguments, religions are often striving to find this optimal balance. If you move too far one way or the other along the spectrum, you get in trouble. If you become too assimilated, then there's no real reason for people to be part of the religion anymore. It offers no uniqueness. But if you go so far at the other end, there's a cost benefit ratio that skews the wrong way. And you get a lot of people disappointed with that as well. For the first part of that the problem of when you become too assimilated, one great example that I was hearing about a few weekends ago at the John Whitmer Historical Association was a fascinating talk about the All Red Polygamist group in Montana, where now that group, you know, you think of fundamentalist Mormons and they are so unique and they have clear boundaries between them and the rest of the world. Well, this group has become, you know, a lot more loose with those boundaries. They've become a bit more assimilated with their surrounding culture. And as a result, they're losing a lot of their members because they just don't see the benefits of the distinction anymore. And so you have to have some sense of remaining distinct and unique while also not moving too far in the other direction. So in Moss's terms, he argues that following the 1890s, where Mormonism has to forego a lot of its unique things like polygamy, the single party system, and they have to become Americanized, that, you know, all the main issues that we talked about when discussing Kathleen Flake's book a month ago, that Mormons became too good at it, that Mormons became too American in Moss's eyes, or in Moss's argument, over the first 50 years of the 20th century. And they had succeeded and they had assimilated to such a point that it had threatened their uniqueness and distinctiveness. And so they had to, in Moss's terms, retrench. They had to, starting in the 50s and 60s, led by a cadre of conservative thinkers, they pushed a more unique message that would reaffirm their cultural roots and become more sect-like in a sense of less like a assimilated church and more like a unique sect. And one good summary of this was found in the introduction on page 6, where he says this retrenchment was, quote, an effort to demonstrate to themselves and to others that Mormons can and ought to exemplify a special posture and lifestyle of austerity, scriptural literalness, and unquestioning obedience to leaders. And to summarize this long summary, the metaphors that Moss uses, of course, is the angel and the beehive. The angel found on the Salt Lake Temple represented the supernatural, the distinctive doctrines of the LDS Church, what makes them unique. And then the beehive, what the symbol that's found on the Hotel Utah next to the Salt Lake Temple, that's supposed to represent the profane, the materialist world, the assimilation, the industrialness of Mormon culture fitting in with the broader American society.
The thing that comes to mind as you're resurrecting this idea for me is the simple idea of the sacred and the profane, which is an important part of even within religion. Like within the temple, you have the celestial room, or within a Catholic cathedral, you have the nave? I can't think of the right terms. But you have these separate places to make them special and unique. And so this is a very important idea in religion.
Right. And it's a constant struggle. It's things that you don't solve at one point and then not have to deal with them anymore. But it's a constant back and forth of handling these complex issues.
All right. So in this book, he has, like we've mentioned, he's using a lot of data. He's got a lot of polls and surveys. And one of the things that I found most interesting, and I put a little note on in the margin on one of these pages where he took note of all the testimonies that were born in Fast and Testimony meeting. And I put in the margin that I want to do this. And it was like a year or more where he took notes of all the testimonies that were born and what subjects they hit on and characterized them so he could tabulate
it. What's really ironic about that is my parents were in his ward.
Oh, really?
during the 1980s. And so I would have been in a toddler in the ward when he was there. My parents, funnily enough, kind of remember him as kind of this old, awkward man in the ward.
taking notes as everyone talks.
Right. So my parents might have been some of the data that he's talking about.
Right. That's funny. But I guess one thing is that, and he makes a point of this in the text, that a lot of the data, the survey data, isn't as strong and as solid as you would like to make hard conclusions because the sample sizes are small. So
they're very small. He wasn't in charge of a lot of the surveys. He's using surveys from other people. It's just like, I mean, they're data that you want to use, but you're just not quite sure how solid they are.
Right. So you put it out there, but you're always putting qualifiers of this kind of looks like this is what's going on, but we're not super certain about
exactly.
it. Exactly. But that's what the data says. So what are you going to do?
So the book is broken up into three parts, and 12 chapters total. The first part is very short. It's just one chapter, and it basically summarizes the theoretical background of church sect development, the idea that for a sect to become the church, it has to drop a lot of its uniqueness and assimilate with broader society. He talks about complex things like cost-benefit theory that probably bores a lot of people who are not religious nerds. And basically setting up the framework that in America, for religions to thrive, they have to assimilate or else they're going to be kicked to the curb. But then once they assimilate, they have to find some ways to stay unique. So that's the first part in the first section. What's really great about the way that Moss structures the book is at the end of each chapter, there's like a one or two or three paragraph summary that really efficiently summarizes everything he had said in the previous chapter in a bite-sized format, to where if you were going to do this, and I'm not saying you should do this, but if you only had, you know, an hour to go through the book, you could just read those summaries at the end of the chapters and basically get the general format of what's going on.
Yeah. As we've talked about with the polygamy books, outside of Danes, I guess, that traces the beginning of this assimilation move. And also one book that we mentioned was the Mormonism in Transition. And so this is the institutional assimilation period, starting in the 1880s or 1890s and moving on and assimilating more and more up to the 1950s, correct?
Correct. And it, what's fascinating is that, I mean, this really, in one sense, is a success story that Mormons become America. They escape their disrepute. They achieve respectability. At the same time, they're taking on, you know, strong identity traits that both make them, you know, firmly Mormon, but also firmly American at the same time. And it kind of shows that when the Mormons put their mind to it, they can really succeed in doing what they want, even if that means becoming American and becoming more like their Protestant neighbors.
One of the points that I found interesting in this section was with regard to education and orthodoxy. Actually, education, location, and orthodoxy. He's looking at groups in San Francisco and Salt Lake, and then the two groups combined, and characterizing their education levels, their type of education, and obviously their location. And he summarizes, in other words, education level has no impact on religious belief for Mormons, a finding incidentally replicated in more recent years. We would thus have not been on firm ground in the 60s to have predicted any loss in Mormon commitment or peculiarity on the basis of greater education. Although in the tables it does show that comparing orthodoxy geographically, Salt Lake City to San Francisco, as you might predict, higher degrees of orthodoxy are observed in Salt Lake City. And probably the most interesting find was when he investigated the type of education with respect to orthodoxy. Most types of education, it didn't matter whether you were in education, you were in a business school, mathematics, or the physical or life sciences. Social sciences were a little bit lower than the rest, but the discipline that produced the lowest amounts of orthodoxy is philosophy and religion. So when he's discussing why the rates of orthodoxy are lower for the social sciences and especially arts and philosophy, he says that the answer is probably that the other disciplines do not confront and challenge traditional religious beliefs, nor do they encourage a view of relativity about religion as much as the social sciences, arts, and philosophy do. But again, like I mentioned, he says, of course, from these data, we can't tell whether training in the social sciences, for example, caused an erosion of orthodoxy or a strongly orthodox worldview led to an avoidance of college disciplines that would threaten traditional beliefs. And the reason I include that last little bit is I find it really responsible or balanced for him to not jump to conclusions and to really draw lines in the sand where the data has applicability.
Right.
So it was interesting, and I think that's generally observed. Philosophy and the social sciences, they do challenge these things that we kind of take for granted if we're not actually studying that area, because we, in those areas, we're studying ourselves. We're studying these social institutions like religions. And it, when you get under the microscope, it does cause you to reevaluate things.
Right. Absolutely.
Along those lines of orthodoxy being damaged, I guess, or reduced by studying religion and philosophy, he had another measure of orthodoxy where he polled dialogue readers, people that subscribe to dialogue, and comparing the Salt Lake group and the San Francisco group in 1967 and 1969, respectively, and the dialogue readers in 1987. The dialogue readers, the people that are interested in studying religion as not just a sacred thing, but as a social phenomenon or a cultural phenomenon, their orthodoxy was much lower than both, than even the San Francisco Mormons. And further, there's another article I want to point the listeners to called The Chicago Experiment, where in the development of the CES program and in an attempt to professionalize the CES instructors, the seminary and institute teachers, they sent some to the University of Chicago, to the University of Chicago's Divinity School. And this article studies or relates what happened to their belief, how many of them retained their original testimony, and how their new teachings or new understandings of scripture and religion were received when they returned from their training in Chicago. It's a really fascinating read.
Right. What also struck me about in these chapters is just how much Mormons were like other Protestants during this age. And he uses a lot of these polling and surveys to kind of get. And of course, you know, you have to wonder about how representative these were. But I mean, Mormons were pretty much like church-going Western Americans during these days. Especially the California Mormons who were polled were very much like white California Protestants. This survey wasn't found in this particular book, but there's another survey that was done by a BYU sociologist where he interviewed a lot of BYU students from like the 1940s on things like belief in a literal hell or a literal devil or the church being the only true church on the earth. And the numbers were surprisingly low, shockingly low almost. And how much it's just not the type of belief that we tend to think for the Mormon tradition, and which kind of gives credence to there was something different going on with Mormons in the pre-1960s period than what happened afterward, which is what Moss talks about in part 3.
Yeah, so this period that is often referred to as retrenchment and labeled that specifically in Moss's book, I actually was wondering your thoughts on this, because it seems like the 1960s produced a lot of reactions, not just within Mormonism, but within religion in America more broadly. Would you agree with that? Is Mormonism retrenching in this time period? Is that just another instantiation of this?
So that's a good question. And let's summarize what he's saying before getting into that, because I think that's an important point. So to summarize what Moss is saying in these chapters is that there is a conscious decision made by a number of church leaders as early as the 1940s, but they really don't become successful and fully operational until the 1960s, that re-emphasize this Mormon orthodoxy, or in Moss's terms, retrenchment. This retrenchment had several key thrusts in Moss's eyes. The key thrusts were reassertion of the principles of continuous revelation through modern prophets, renewed emphasis on genealogy and temple work, the missionary program, family renewal and retrenchment, and religious education. And he also uses another chapter, the case studies of the King James Bible, as well as their attachment to conservative politics. And all of this is done in an attempt to make a distinctive Mormon mindset and establish a Mormon fundamentalism that would reaffirm their sense of Mormonness. So that's the summary. And to your important question now, I'm thinking that retrenchment is probably the wrong word for what's going on here. Mostly because retrenchment would mean that it's only internal looking, which is, of course, Moss's whole point, that it's all about them trying to prove uniqueness. Whereas I don't think that's fully the case. I don't think they're trying to divorce make more distinctive their connection with broader America, as they are trying to reaffirm a central connection to a particular version of America. I think it's not a coincidence that the main leaders that are leading this quote-unquote retrenchment effort are also those who are involved in nationwide movements for the rise of the religious right. And so it's not so much a separation from American culture as it is an attachment to conservative religious culture. So in some ways, where Moss is saying that they're trying to decrease their assimilation, I would argue that they're actually becoming more assimilated to a particular demographic and cultural movement within America.
And simultaneously separating from mainline Protestantism and liberal views.
Right. And this goes into when Moss is saying that they're moving away from Americanism. You can guess what does he mean by Americanism, which to him, it means intellectual progressive values.
Right. Yes.
And so if you're defining America that way, then yes, Mormonism is retrenching away from those values at an institutional level. But I think it's also fair to say that after the 1960s, Mormonism becomes more American. We become more consumer. We become more a part of the two-party system. We become more a part of business circles and legal circles and other things. And I think it's just not the case that we're moving away, but we're just assimilating in different areas.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I can see the basis for that argument. One point that he does make in this idea of retrenchment and assimilation that I think does get oversimplified a lot as people reference it. You know, someone might give a more fundamentalist or a more literalist talk in general conference, and then suddenly there's an uproar that we're retrenching.
Right.
You know, as if this idea of retrenchment is something that happens, you know, over the course of a couple days or, you know, maybe even a couple years at most. But these are big, long periods of times in which these shifts take place. And he's also looking back on stuff that's already happened. He's not reacting to events that have happened last week.
Right.
This is sort of a post hoc analysis, if you will. And he also says there's seeds of retrenchment or seeds of assimilation planted while the opposite movement is thriving.
Right.
So while assimilation is occurring up into the 1950s, we have Joseph Fielding Smith fighting evolution and biblical criticism, higher criticism of the Bible as his life quest, basically. Right. And so among the assimilation movement, there's retrenchment figures. And then among it, within the retrenchment phase, there's going to be assimilators, if you will. Assimilators towards the intellectual world.
Absolutely.
Intellectual
and so
America.
There's little battles going on all the time. But what Moss is mostly interested in is the broader war.
Right. Like, yeah. And I just worry about that being off. It's one of my pet peeves of oversimplifying things. And so I just have to say, now hold on. This is a big thing that he's talking about. It's not just one element or one statement is either retrenchment or assimilation statements or elements. It's a big description, big broad description.
Right. Absolutely.
There's one more thing that, along with the simple narratives that I get concerned about, is this idea that the church is very conservative, which it is. But one section of the book where he was incorporating data from other researchers, other non-LDS researchers, a bunch of survey data covering a broad range of religions in the United States, and put them on a spectrum from conservative to liberal, and on a variety of measures, Mormons were on the liberal side.
Right.
And it's just a reminder that within religion in America, there's a lot of conservative religions. It's not just us and, you know, some of the very conservative Catholic priests. There's tons of conservative religions that are, you know, the whole evangelical movement, the Pentecostal movement, they make our conservatism look pretty weak by comparison at times.
Right. Good to have that comparison there.
Right. Yeah. Just to put it in perspective, I think, and map it out well.
So I think there's a few broad lessons that can be taken out of Angel and the Beehive, and why I think it's, even if I have some problems with some analysis and approach, some really important things part of it. Most especially that you see a map for how Mormonism functions. As you mentioned, there's these seeds of retrenchment and assimilation going on at all the times. And you can see how Mormonism doesn't move in one direction all the time and then another direction for another period of time. But it's often a battle along a spectrum moving back and forth, and it's much more fluid. And secondly, one reason I like it is because it's such a personal narrative. I mean, he doesn't come out and say this, but what Moss is trying to trace here is him basically asking, what the hell happened to the church in my teens and
20s? Yeah, exactly.
He wants to know what happened to the Mormonism in the 1950s and 1960s. He also wants to explain why Mormon intellectuals are alienated. It's not a coincidence that this book is published a year after the September 6th.
Mm.
Right? This is a moment of progressive Mormon reassessment of understanding what is the role of intellectuals in Mormonism. And this book gives a framework for how Mormonism got to where it was in the 1990s.
Yeah, so for me, I kind of swallowed his argument whole, but I found it quite compelling, and I really enjoyed looking at all the data and looking at the shifts in culture over time. So for me, it was just a joy to read. But I think a follow-up to this, there's two books that I want to recommend that expand or extend some of the ideas that he's got going here. And one is Mormons in the Bible, that I'm actually right in the middle of right now, by Phil Barlow.
The great book.
Yeah, he talks about how Mormons have approached the Bible from the beginning, from before Mormonism, so 1820 to 1830, before it was an official religion, and all the way up through his latest update is up to 2013. He just had another edition come out 2 years ago. So that's a really good one. And another one It's called Seeking the Promised Land, which takes more survey data. It's a political science / sociology religious studies book that specifically looks at Mormonism in America with recent survey data. And it would be interesting for someone to, for an interested reader to compare the trends that Moss has over time and then add in this new data from Seeking the Promised Land and see if we can tie that all together.
Absolutely. And also good to know that Armin Moss wrote a article that was published in Dialogue a few years ago. That's kind of like an added chapter on the book of what's happened since 1994.
Oh, yeah. I'll have to look that one up. I haven't read that. All right. Well, that is Angel and the Beehive. Again, this one isn't a doorstop. It's just over 200 pages, 212 pages before you get to the notes section. And the appendix is all his survey methods. For those social scientists that are just coming across this book, you'll probably be interested in how he collected his data. But it's really not too long of a read, but it's full of a wealth of information. And it gives at least a good view of how Mormonism shifts culturally and doctrinally, really. So it's a great book. Thanks again, Ben, for coming on and introducing another top 10 book in Mormon history.
Glad to be here.
Well, there you are. One more book to put on your shelf if you haven't read that one already. While you're here listening, I'll ask you a quick favor. If you appreciate the ideas presented and discussed in this podcast, head over to iTunes, please. Go to the Rational Face podcast within iTunes and leave a rating and a short review. If this is the only series you listen to, write that in the rating. Increasing our visibility in iTunes and having individuals share episodes are the only ways that we have to increase the listenership of the Rational Face podcast. So help a guy out, won't you? As for next week, you can look forward to the audio that I captured of our Sunstone presentation at Sunstone Kirtland that was presented on October 17th. On that post, you'll also find a PDF of the slides that we presented with, so you can flip through those as you listen to the podcast, or you can look at them later, whatever you want to do. But that's what we've got. And as always, keep keeping it weird.